Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
This is Alex Ross, and you're listening to The Fool and the Opera. And if I had to review this show for The New Yorker, I'd say it's an hour of annoying noise.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera. It's a very dark sort of an evening night tonight. You know that winter's coming along when it's so dark outside. And I suppose it's a nice sort of setting for today's theme, which is mysterious paths, distant reflections and common passions. On today's show, I'm very lucky to be graced by the presence of two men who are from opposite ends of the world. But of course, they share the same commonality, which is a passion for opera. I caught up earlier this week with New Yorker Alex Ross, who was in Sydney for the Sydney Writers Festival, and he's also he's very well respected as a opera critic, and he writes for the New Yorker, and also he has written a book called "The Rest Is Noise." I had to think about that one there for a second. "The Rest Is Noise." A fantastic title. If you think about it, the rest in music is the bit where you pause, and the rest being noise is very in line with what the book is about, where, you know, in this 21st century now, we're just filled with a cacophony of noise. So catch up with him, and we're playing the highlights of that interview for you a little bit later on. And also, I've also got New Zealander Hadley Adams coming in. He's a bass baritone, and he's sort of rising in the ranks of the people in opera to watch. He's come over here on a scholarship, and he's here is very good, and we'll be talking with him a little bit about, I suppose, education in opera. How do you become a good opera singer? So it's going to be quite interesting. Now, this week, it's very we get to return to the usual format. We've had two specials in a row, which has been lovely. This week, we kind of go back to the format where, you know, I start the show with a song that's completely bizarre and quirky. And this week, I've been sitting on this for quite a while. It's called Sitting on Content. And you can do it the same thing by just grabbing a couple of books and sitting on them. The Decembrists have written folk opera. Their current album, The Hazards of Love, has been described as a folk opera. And a lot of the concerts that they're doing around America also play on that theme. And what is a folk opera? Well, opera, you know, as you know, is the sort of the synthesis of music and story together in one, and it, you know, continues through, and it really doesn't separate itself. It's always connected together. And in this particular case, the folk opera is the album that they've written, The Hazards of Love. And sort of flows through as a full story, and you can get the story from the start, and it kind of follows through, and all the characters sort of, I suppose, they develop and they change, and the story as well also goes along. So it's a very good album. You've got to listen to it from start to finish to get the whole point. But this particular song, which was the one that they sort of released as the song to for the album, is called The Rake's Song, and I quite like it. It's very interesting. And the theme in it is also quite operatic in terms of it's about a man who tells of the children he's had and the children that he's killed. So it's sort of a very operatic sort of a theme. So this is The Rake Song by the Decembrists. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9.
We'll be right back.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that was, of course, The Decemberists. That's right, The Decemberists, and from their album The Hazards of Love, a folk opera album. Very interesting music, and I really like the fact that, you know, you can kind of sort of take things like that and sort of take them onto a stage and turn an album into a story on stage as well. So definitely worth checking out. You can check it out on iTunes. That's where I got mine from, but there's a few other artists that are starting to do the whole opera thing. You know, there's Jade Gulliver from Different Strokes let me know earlier in the month about Green Day. Their American Idiot album is now being turned into a rock opera, a staging that is completely separate from what they do, but all the same, you know, turning that album into a story where, you know, you can actually take the characters and sort of follow it through. So definitely very interesting stuff, and definitely worth checking out. And I suppose that if Alex Ross, you know, heard that, he'll be quite happy with it, because his book, The Rest Is Noise, is all about, you know, how classical music relates to pop and jazz and rock and all those sorts of things. And I was very lucky to catch up with him while he was on break in Sydney from the Sydney Writers Festival, and had a chat with him about, you know, all the different things that, you know, why do we still categorise from classical and pop and rock and all this sort of stuff. And he had some very interesting responses. So this is going to be the highlights of my interview with Alex Ross, and you're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Alex Ross has been a music critic for The New Yorker since 1996 and is the best-selling author of the book The Rest Is Noise, a juicy tale of classical music in the 20th century and its rollicking romps with pop, jazz and rock. He's currently in Sydney for the Writers' Festival. Thanks very much for joining me, Alex.
Sure, great to be here, thanks.
In today's day and age, everyone's sort of very driven to identify and categorise music, you know, pop, jazz, classical and all that sort of stuff. And your book sort of reminds us all that music has a common ancestry.
Yeah, I mean, it is a book about classical music, technically. I mean, that's the main concentration is on classical composers in the 20th century. But I'm always very keen to notice the moments at which the boundary blurs a bit between classical music and other kinds of music. So in an early chapter, I talk quite a bit about American jazz in the 1920s and 30s and how composers like Copland and Gershwin and Duke Ellington were at some moments really speaking the same language. And then later in the book, I talk about the back and forth between the avant-garde of the 60s and 70s and rock and roll in that period, the Beatles and the Velvet Underground and Brian Eno and so forth. And so you can sort of pick up a certain thread and follow it outside of a particular genre into other genres. And I find that a wonderful way to listen and not to be confined by one genre.
And in terms of the genre of classical music, you've said that classical music isn't really a superior product to sell. It's more a way of life. And a lot of people who sort of start to categorize it into a separate category forget that.
Yeah, I mean, it's about passion and emotion. It's not a purely intellectual art form, nor is it about status and joining a particular elite. So, I mean, that's been forgotten a bit, or I think the image that classical music has in the popular imagination leads you to think otherwise. So I'm always very keen when I write about music and talk about music to emphasize the emotional as well as the intellectual, to talk about the lives of composers and what they went through as human beings and what led them to write in a particular way.
Well, in terms of your articles when you write for The New Yorker, I mean, a lot of your... I'm probably going to be one of the most lowbrow person you've ever spoken to. Like, you know, the people who read your articles are probably richer, older, more culturally aware than I am. And just like, how do you maintain that sort of space for beginners in a world where it is kind of almost very locked in?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I mean, The New Yorker, which I write for, is a magazine with a very diverse readership. You know, some young, some old, some rich, some kind of school teachers who make very little money. And so I never really know who I'm writing for, actually. And I always try to gauge my writing for almost anyone. I mean, I want to produce something that will be of interest both to, you know, the person who has the you know, the 25 recordings of Traviata, as well as the person who's never heard of the opera. And you know, the wonderful challenge is finding something that will make sense to them both. And so my pieces sort of veer back and forth between, you know, slightly more esoteric kind of points about the inside of the music, and then just the basic introduction: who is this composer? What's this piece about? And what's, you know, why should you listen to it?
Sure. And in terms of the way that you write as well, you also write very well in terms of textually, musically, you know all the intricacies of the music, and yet you can also explain it with very vivid images. Like, I just want to quote you from your book as well. Britain made his inner landscape as vivid as the rumble of the sea, the cries of the gulls and the scuttling of the crabs, which I find quite poetic. Like, when you listen to music and you're just listening to music and you're not in front of, at the opera, can you see things when you're listening to music? What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, certain images come to mind. I mean, in that case with Britain, I was just thinking back to being in Aldeburgh, that little coastal town where Britain lived for so much of his life, and also where the events of Peter Grimes are set. And I love going to places where the composer lived, or a place that has some connection to a particular piece, because, you know, I mean, the music is the music, and, you know, there are no definite images attached to it very often, and then you sort of free to invent your own images. But I actually really love associating it with particular places and with my travels and my own experiences. So and I think Britain was, you know, he was definitely trying to summon a sense of the seascape and the gulls and the sort of little creatures scurrying on the beach, and put that into the music.
Now, in the book, there's a small section about sort of gay composers like Copland and Bernstein and Barber and Cage and Tippett. Like, I never was aware that there were so many gay composers out there, which is great.
I know, there are a lot. I mean, I think classical music, and actually composing music in particular, became a refuge for a lot of people. And, you know, the thing about music is you can sort of say what's in your innermost heart without necessarily spelling it out in words. And, you know, I think this is why Shostakovich, not a gay composer, but as a composer sort of oppressed by the political system in the Soviet Union, was able to use music to express certain things that he could never have spoken out loud. And I think in the same way, you know, all these, especially these American composers who, gay composers who gravitated toward music as a form of expression, where they had that freedom, and you know, they could be themselves in purely musical form. And, you know, to be you know, to love classical music in America, I mean, it is to be labeled a sissy. You know, this it's always been this way for, I think, you know, at least 100 years. But at the same time, it can be a refuge for so many kids who aren't going to fit in with sort of conventional masculine kind of culture and the sort of music that goes along with it.
Sure. So they're sort of attracted to the story that, or the music, because the music already has that sort of that feel that they would just so readily identify with.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when you listen to pop songs, and it's always spelled out for you. You know, the guy's in love with a girl. And, you know, I think when you come to, you know, a Tchaikovsky symphony, there's this, obviously, this passion, sort of, you know, overwhelming, intense feeling, but, you know, who's feeling what for whom, you know, who knows? It's not spelled out. And actually, you know, we know from Tchaikovsky's life, I mean, he was gay, and I think the later symphonies are sort of secret diaries of his life. And I think that's remained the case for
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we are having a good time here in the studio. Hadley Adams is coming a little bit earlier, and we're just chatting about opera things, and it's quite exciting that we've got a live interview. I always get excited when we have a live guest in the interview. Not a live guest, because the guests are always alive, but a guest live in the studio, rather. And, you know, today we've got talented bass baritone New Zealander Hadley Adams in the studio, and, of course, I'm going to continue with the interview with Alex Ross from New York. So we've got a New York, New Zealander. You know, we can redo that whole song, New York, New York, New York, New Zealand. But if you've got SMS SMSs or emails you want to send in, you can do it via 0427JOY949. You can email onair@joy.org.au. We've also got Jerry on the desk, so 96992949 is the number to call. Because, yeah, a little bit later on, if you want to ask Mr. Adams anything about opera, and he's making a bit of a splash in the opera world in Melbourne at the moment, and he's already got a cabinet full of awards, so good on him, and it would be great to have a chat with him a little bit about, you know, how to get there in the opera world through his eyes. So if you've got any questions, please do get in touch, and you know, we're going to be Twittering as well, and there's the blog as well, so check it all out, joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. Now, we were chatting with Alex Ross, and before the beautiful track that was from Onegin, Eugene Onegin, and it's Lenski's aria, and sung by Stuart Burrows with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House in the UK. A very beautiful track, and we're talking about, you know, composers who are gay, and people who are in opera who are gay, and of course as well, you know, himself being a gay man as well, and just wanted to talk to him about, at that point, I suppose, about what it was like for him starting out in opera, and whether the fact that, you know, as so many gay people are attracted to opera, whether that was an influence in his own life. So I'm going to continue with the interview highlights with Alex Ross. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Is it what attracted you to the genre of opera as well?
I don't know. I mean, I guess sort of subconsciously, just, you know, sort of growing up gay, or I wasn't out of the closet until after college, but I did definitely gravitate toward classical music and opera a little later myself, very instinctively and automatically, and so I guess maybe something of the same thing was going on with me, but I don't know. I mean, then I just, you know, yeah, I think, you know, anyone can fall in love with this music, and obviously you don't need to be gay to like opera, so I mean, I don't want to sort of have it be too closely tied together. It's all hard for me to figure out, you know, where does one thing begin and the other end. I mean, it all sort of flows together in my own life.
Okay. Well, how did you find your talent? Because writing, you know, reviews for opera isn't, I suppose, a typical job that a young kid would sort of say, that's what I want to do when I grow up.
Right. Well, I didn't really intend to do it myself. I was very serious about music and studying the piano and composition and trying to write music, and when that kind of petered out, I obviously didn't have the talent for it. I thought, well, that's that. I'll sort of do something else with my life. Majored in English in college and was probably planning to have some kind of, you know, academic career, and was, you know, assumed that I'd sort of still keep up with music on the side, and I just didn't really realize that you could necessarily make a living writing about music. It's, I knew there were a few people, you know, around the country who had jobs as music critics, but it didn't seem like there were any openings, and I really kind of found myself doing it first as a freelancer and then as a regular gig after college, and then I realized, well, maybe I can make a living doing this, but it's difficult. It's a very difficult business to break into, and there's no really set path. I think people who become music critics, there's always these kind of odd little twists and turns in their story, and very few of us, I think, really planned on doing it for a living.
And in terms of what you sort of write quite regularly, you've also got the blog as well, which you kind of use as another sort of platform for discussing classical music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really fun. It's obviously it's a very different kind of writing. I don't even really write that much on the blog in a formal sense. It's, I have little items, links to things I find interesting, wacky videos, you know, put some audio up there of music, which, you know, sort of new CDs that I'm listening to, and the site is therustisnoise.com, and I have a whole bunch of pages devoted to my book of the same title, musical illustrations that go along with each chapter. So that's a very nice resource that the internet has added. And I enjoy reading the other blogs out there and, you know, keeping up with them. And it's a great new format, I think, a great new medium for people to express their interest in classical music and opera. There's some very lively, kind of gossipy, bitchy opera blogs out there, which are incredibly fun to read, and that's kind of one of the liveliest subgenres of classical blogging right now.
In terms of when we talk about different forms of media as well, you've kind of explored quite a few. I mean, you were a radio presenter for a non-profit broadcaster in America as well.
Yeah, well, in college, I was spent a huge amount of time on my college radio station, which is really, that's where I started writing about music, because we had a program guide that we put out, and I'd write some CD reviews for that. And that was also where I really started getting into 20th century music, all the music that I write about in my book. I discovered a lot of that at the radio station, just browsing through the LPs, and it really sort of expanded my horizons in other ways, because I also, you know, I grew up listening only to classical music and just really thought that all of pop music was total rubbish. Once I got to my college station, I mean, there were all these kind of, you know, brilliant, fascinating, kind of quirky people who were doing the punk rock show and the hip hop shows, and I realized, wow, maybe there's something to this, and I sort of got to know them first, and then I started listening to their music, and that really expanded my horizons vastly.
Why was it that you grew up listening to just classical music?
I don't know. I mean, it was just kind of the only music that made sense to me for so long. I just naturally gravitated to it. My parents had a nice classical LP collection, but they didn't really force me to listen to it. I just naturally took to it, and it was a little bit odd. I mean, of course, people grow up, you know, sharing their musical tastes, and that made me a little bit of an oddball in my high school, but that's just the way it was. I just wasn't quite ready for it, and I was just so passionate about the classical music, I just didn't really have time for anything else.
Now, just to quickly wrap up, I wanted to get from you just a very quick idea of what you think makes a good opera.
What makes a good opera?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you a good story is can help, although it's not essential. I mean, we all know, you know, our favorite operas that just don't make any sense at all in terms of the story. I think I do start with the music. I mean, it's probably the music that grabs me the most, but you know, the great opera composers really knew how to organize an act. I think sort of the greatest operas are the ones in which sort of each act of the piece is kind of a unit in itself and takes you on a journey, and then the next act sort of builds on that. Wagner was just a master of, I mean, we think of Wagner as the composer who goes on and on and on, and yet if you just look at how each act of his operas is constructed, it's really masterful, and he really knows, you know, how to sort of control the ebb and flow of tension and how to build to a climax or to a sort of a shocking revelation of one kind or another, and you're just swept up in it, and I love that feeling, and you're not sure, is it the story, is it the music? You know, if you listen to the music just on its own, it doesn't really make sense without the words, but when you look at the words on the page, you know, they can just seem a bit ridiculous on their own. It's the combination, and so that's obviously the key to opera, how music and words play off each other and add up to something bigger than either unit of the equation.
Well, Alex Ross, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, sure, thank you.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that was a beautiful little aria. It was a gift from our guest today, Hadley Adams. And I'll introduce you, Hadley, and then we'll
sure,
get straight into
sure.
it. Hadley Adams is a gentleman in opera who's sort of heading places. In fact, he's always started heading. He's gone from New Zealand to Melbourne on a scholarship, and he's been chosen for the Melbourne Opera School as their scholarship recipient. Mm-hmm. And semester one's about to finish, so he's here to talk a little bit about what's coming up concert-wise, I suppose. So thanks for joining me in the studio.
Pleasure.
And throughout that whole, I suppose, aria. Oh, actually, could you please just introduce what the aria was?
It was Mein Sehnen, Mein Wehnen from Die Tote Stadt by Korngold.
I'm so glad you said it.
It's one of those pieces, it's kind of not main fare, but it's so extraordinarily beautiful and incredibly hot. And I don't know if you hear that, you know, there's chord changes near the beginning, and the whole way through it, it's such a journey, and it's such a huge, I don't know, it really hits me. I don't know, right in the heart whenever I hear it.
That was the thing that I've been struck with while you've been sitting in the studio. We've had a few minutes to kind of just talk and that sort of thing. And the thing that really struck me was the fact that in your eyes, there's this, just this, I don't know, it's a shiny sort of look. You know, you're really in love with opera, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I knew I wanted to be an opera singer when I was 10. From a very small rural city slash town, no offense, home folks, New Zealand called Palmerston North. And just since I was 10, when I first heard an aria on my parents' old records from Tosca by Puccini, Visi d'Arte, that I wanted to be an opera singer. To me, it just made so much sense. It was real and emotive and incredibly passionate. And, I mean, that aria where she is crying out to God for help. And, I mean, at 10, you can't understand the gravity of the situation she's in. But I knew that she was singing without a microphone over this huge orchestra in a big theatre, and she was really sad.
Mm.
And I went, I'm going to do that. It just made sense to me, and it was so real. It's not as heightened, and, you know, stereotypes aside, opera is the most incredible art form when it's done well.
In terms of from that moment when you were 10, like, where did that journey begin then? What did you start doing in order to kind of get to where you are, where now you kind of, you know, you do have a cabinet full of awards?
Yeah, well, I, as I said, I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I started piano and violin and things a bit earlier, which I'm really grateful for now, because you get new music, and if you can sit down and play it at the piano just to know what you're doing, it's such a benefit. And I couldn't fathom being a singer who couldn't play piano. It must be incredibly difficult. Just knowing, you know, just being able to learn things yourself without the use of an accompanist or a repetiteur.
Can you self-accompany?
I'm sorry?
Can you self-accompany while you're singing? Or?
Kind of an Elton John kind of thing. Yeah, no, you know, your singing teacher would have a field day with your technique and breathing and your support. No, but yeah, so I went through high school, and, you know, as you do, you know, you think you want to be a singer, so you sing a lot during high school. Then you get to university and start studying, you realise it was slightly detrimental to do all that singing. I mean, New Zealand, a great place to grow up wanting to be a classical singer, because there's so much opportunity if you show you want it and you're hungry for it and you work hard. And so I just kept putting my hand up to do everything. I mean, nothing silly, nothing like Verdi or Wagner, but anything that was appropriate, like, you know, Handel, Bach, Mozart, anything I could do, I would always put my hand up for and work really hard towards. And so after I finished my undergrad at the University of Auckland, I did my honours there, then my master's at University of Victoria Wellington, not related to Victoria. And yeah, then I was the emerging artist with New Zealand Opera. Official title there being the National Business Review New Zealand Opera PricewaterhouseCoopers Dame Alvina Major Foundation Emerging Artist.
So it's a small title.
It's a mouthful. And yeah, and now I'm very, very happy to be here.
And in terms of while you're here at the moment with the Opera School Melbourne, you've had some, you know, I've quickly read through the prospectus, I think, of who's, you know, and some of the people are Brian Castle's Onion, Millen Quaife, you know, coming in. And how have you found that experience with having all these sort of, I suppose, well-established people?
It's been utterly fantastic. I was looking at heading over to the Royal College of Music, the Royal Academy in London. I had some scholarships to head over there. And then actually, purely by chance, I found about the Opera School Melbourne online. And I looked at the music staff on site, the artistic director, Linda Thompson, the head of music, Andrea Katz, with such a breadth of knowledge between them, and two people who genuinely, really, truly care about the future of opera in this country. And the guest faculty, as you mentioned, like a who's who of Australian singing. And coming from New Zealand, we have a little friendly banter, but we're really good neighbours. I feel we're great neighbours, and it's a real privilege to be in Melbourne in the studio, but to be with these incredibly respected artists and to learn from them is the most rewarding experience, because you learn from doing. And we have so many masterclasses, so many workshops with these artists who just know so much more than you could ever, you know, hope to know in a lifetime. And it's been just fantastic just to get to know these people and to talk to them and how what they learnt and what they wish they had known going into it when they were younger.
Right. Is there a particular, you know, what they wish they had known that strikes in your mind? That,
you know, not yet. I'm sure there's kind of been so many, it's hard to pick one out. But it's interesting as well in that regard. I mean, they'll say things that, you know, you're starting to figure out now, and trying to find your own path in all of this is there's no one right way to go about a career in opera. That's what I'm really realizing. I mean, I've got a long way to go myself. I'm not deluding myself. I'm only 24, and I have a huge amount to learn. But that's what I love about this.
Yeah.
You reach your potential. You reach your peak at about 40, 45 as a man. And I find that so incredibly remarkable that you just keep learning and you can't stop learning. Yeah.
Well, one of the, I think, the most important things about opera in terms of learning is learning by practicing. You know, in terms of performance, that's the moment where you learn the most. And we'll talk a little bit later about some of your performances coming up. But we've got a track lined up, Visi d'arte.
Yeah, great.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that sort of that moment when, you know?
Sure. So what about, do you mean what was happening, or the moment about the piece?
The moment when it happened.
Oh, okay. You
know,
yeah.
When you're a 10 and, I don't know, do you remember what you were wearing, where you were? You know?
Outback New Zealand. yeah, that's what you're waiting for, wasn't it? Yeah. you know, I was literally just in my bedroom and found my parents' old vinyl records. Not my old parents' vinyl records, but my parents' old vinyl records. And, I put it on the spindle and it just went to Visi d'arte, this most famous aria, of course. And it was funny. It was such a visceral experience. This woman, and the recording was with Maria Callas, and, you know, who often still gets criticized so much, but I'm like, you know what? She's amazing and she's fantastic and she means what she says. She's brilliant. And it's just a... it's hard to describe when you feel something so innate what happens to you, but it made sense, and like nothing else has ever made sense in my life. And that's what I find so funny. I mean, the stereotype, of course, you can't blame people for having a stereotype about what opera is when all you get shown is the large lady with the horns and the breastplate on a big stage. But it's never, ever been that to me. It's made so much sense, and it's so down-to-earth and real and incredibly passionate in so many ways. And, yeah, it was because of that moment that I was just kind of like, as a kid, I was waiting for something to wake me up out of my life, in a way. I mean, not to say, I mean, I love my hometown, I do, and New Zealand is a fantastic place to be. I mean, my little hometown, which will always be home for me, I knew that I was destined for different things. Not better things, but just different things. And that, for me, this is where my life is headed and this is what's right.
Okay. Well, you're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. This is Visi d'arte from Tosca. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. That was Maria Callas with Visi d'arte from Tosca.
Good pronunciation there, Dan.
Yes.
Well,
finally. Hadley Adams has joined me this year, a bass baritone from New Zealand.
How's that
pronunciation?
That was 7 out of 10.
I promised myself I wouldn't do that, but I ended up
doing
it.
None of you people can resist. You love it. It's like, oh, boo, your beach tears, boo.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit, Hadley, about, look, this can't be missed. You've done modelling, so you are an attractive young man, and I can say that because I'm 2 years older than you. Now, I've listened to a few, and I've read a few articles, and I've listened to a few articles, and it seems to be you've kind of get pigeonholed into that, you know, he's from New Zealand, he's attractive, and, you know, this is what he's singing. Like, do you feel that that's...
It's a really interesting observation, I guess. I mean, it's always nice when someone thinks you look attractive. It's quite a compliment. But it's interesting because, you know, the whole opera world and, you know, this whole Fat Lady Sings too. There's an amazing article called The Fit Lady Sings in Opera Now from a few years ago, how it was, you know, the change to model, singers having to fit into a size 8 or, you know, to be in a bikini on stage to play their roles. And it's an interesting one. And for me, I think it's almost like a self-perpetuating... I mean, I'm speaking completely out of turn. I have nothing to base this on, just, you know, my own view of it, the small amount I've seen. And then, for me, I don't it's about the music in the end and about the commitment to what someone's singing. I mean, these days, Mimi and Rodolfo and La Boheme have to be so attractive, but you know what? Traditionally attractive, and they don't have to be. I mean, all they have to show us is that they're in love with each other. And I think it's quite a slippery slope when you go, it all becomes all about how someone looks, because the music suffers. But at the same time, you've got to respect that, you know, the likes of Il Divo and Andrea Bocelli and Amici Forever, as, you know, as popular as they are, have done a lot of good for opera, because it has brought people to the form who otherwise wouldn't be aware of it or wouldn't know it. Because opera as an art form is quite difficult to get into. I mean, how do you look at the past 300-400 years of music and say, where do you start? If you want to even approach it, where do you go first? If you don't like one piece, I mean, a lot of my friends listen to one opera and say, oh, no, I don't like opera because I don't like that one. Yep. As opposed to, you know, the other 2,500 examples.
I mean, what is it? We've been recycling our music since the 16th century. There's a lot of music.
145, chord 145. No, it's flattering for me. I find it flattering, but at the end, it's about the music, and I do this because I love what I do, and to me, the music is the most important thing. And without that, I mean, if someone looks fine to me on stage, but they don't sound good, I don't care. It's a difficult question to get into, but for me, ultimately, the music, you're there to serve the music, not to wear tight clothes.
Well, I mean, you know, just Teddy Tahu Rhodes is another New Zealander who, you know,
yeah,
sort of goes off and gets his gear off quite often on the opera stage. I mean, is that what it takes now to be sexy in opera? Like, just physically sexy, or are there other things that we can do in opera to make it sexy to the public?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I wouldn't know how to answer that. I think it comes down to charisma in the end. I mean, you know, some people who have larger frames are incredibly, you know, even traditionally attractive because they have that charisma and it's the way you hold yourself, I think. And I suppose it depends. You know, if a director is casting, they're going to go for a look. If a music director is casting, they're going to go for a sound. It all depends on the company and what they're trying to achieve at that particular moment, I would think.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the stuff that you're doing on stage, because we're running out of time.
Sorry.
We had a quick SMS that came in, and it's from Paul, who said, Dan, who sang the Corn Golden? I'm hoping you can answer that one for me, please.
American baritone Thomas Hampson, from the CD The Very Best of Thomas Hampson.
Excellent. Now, let's talk about your productions that are coming up. One's the Mozart Requiem, and there's another, I think, Marvelous Mozart's coming up as well.
Yeah, we're doing Mozart Soiree at Ravenswood, a beautiful old homestead in Ivanhoe, yes. And information about that is at www.theopperschool.com.au. It's going to be a fantastic evening. And Glenn Winslade, amazing Haldon tenor, Australian Haldon tenor, who's now teaching in Sydney, is coming down to workshop we've got scenes from Le Nozze di Figaro, Così fan tutte, Don Giovanni, and so it's going to be a lot of fun, actually. So it's going to be a great night, and we're all very, very much looking forward to working with someone who's so incredibly well-versed in Mozart.
Great. Well, I'm also looking forward to, because I'll get to see you on stage for the first time, which I'm quite excited about. So
stress.
We'll decide if I invite you back ever again.
Oh, that was pleasant.
No. Well, very quickly wrapping up, what is it like to be on stage?
For me, it's kind of, every time I go out on stage, it's kind of like you're about to walk in the front door of your house, and your whole room is filled with people who are about to yell out surprise, and they don't know you know, but you do, and you found out. And it's a moment just before you turn the light on, and they all yell out surprise, because you know that they're all there rooting for you, and they're all there to enjoy themselves. And for me, going out on stage feels like I'm going home, and it feels like I'm just in a room full of people having a party. And it's the most incredible experience, and I'm so humbled that this is what I'm going to be doing with my life.
Well, Hadley Adams, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure.
I'll make sure to post up all the information about his upcoming performances on the blog, joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. Now, Oh, I've got a giveaway as well. I forgot about it. You can give us a call, 96992949. Jerry's there on the front desk. We have got a copy of Alex Ross's The Rest Is Noise. So it's a fantastic book. It's huge. It's a tome. So definitely give him a call. And yeah, the first caller will get that book. Now, we like to finish the show always with a bit of a jazz track because it leads into the next show. And, you know, Bent Notes, definitely stick around. 2 hours of great jazz. This one's Lenski's Aria. It's Onegin Line by the Opera Big Band. And Antti Sapila, and it's from the album Swinging the Opera, and I hope you enjoy it. You're on The Fool and the Opera. Enjoy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. It's sad how time just goes so quickly when we do the show. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And as always, you know, who is this, who's going to be the person today? Well, I think it's going to be Tchaikovsky. As Tchaikovsky always says, I'll see you next week. Same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel. And definitely stick around for Kirsten with Bent Notes. This has been The Fool and the Opera.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.